Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
On Tuesday evening, May 5th, on HBO, a new documentary film is debuting, and it is titled Natalie Wood, What Remains Behind. It is promised to be an illuminating exploration of Natalie Wood and her very, very successful career. And we have with us Natalie Wood's daughter, Natasha Gregson-Wagner, an actress in her own right, who is one of the producers of this film. And we have the next few minutes to talk with Natasha Gregson-Wagner about the career of her mother and their relationship. Natasha Gregson-Wagner is someone whose work you have perhaps seen in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, or Heart to Heart, or Lost Highway, or Two Girls and a Guy, or High Fidelity, or any number of other projects that she has been involved in over the years. And again, she is one of the producers of Natalie Wood, What Remains Behind. Natasha Gregson-Wagner, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Oh, thank you so much, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here talking to you.
And I should think that it was nothing less than a labor of love for you to help put together this documentary about your mother. Tell us, first of all, how the project first began. Is this an idea of yours or someone else's?
Well, in 2016, I co-authored a coffee table book with Manoah Bowman on my mom's life called Natalie Wood, Reflections on a Legendary Life. And while we were researching that project, we had come across so much material in our family archives that we said to each other, goodness gracious, one day we really should make a documentary on her life. And about a year later, Manoah called me and said, I've got the guy to make the documentary. He's a very, very well-respected documentarian named Laurent Bouzereau. And so the three of us met, and Laurent and I had the same vision for the documentary, and we were sort of off to the races after that.
Wonderful. So tell us a little bit about the process by which this film took shape. In particular, the kind of conversations that you had with him, and the kind of reflection that you each did in terms of telling this story as effectively and honestly and compellingly as you could.
Well, like I said earlier, we had so much material, and luckily, since I was not the director, I left all that into Laurent's capable hands. He had to really whittle it down and choose what was most poignant and what helped, you know, tell our story. We knew that we wanted to interview my family. We knew we were going to reach out to Robert Redford and Mia Farrow and different, you know, luminaries that she was close to. And we knew really that the crux of the film would kind of rest on the conversation I would have with my stepdad, Robert Wagner, about the night my mom passed away. And so that interview is what we shot first over a two-day period, because we felt that if that interview didn't go in the direction that we wanted it to, you know, we would have a hard time making the documentary. But my stepdad was so forthcoming. He was so present and just, you know, full of humanity and truth. And so we were so excited after that interview. We felt like we really knew the direction that the film was going to take.
Hmm. I have read that the film is distinctive, among other reasons, for the wealth of previously unseen footage that is part of this. I mean, private home movies and photographs and diaries and so on. First of all, give us a sense of what it was like to kind of make your way through this enormous personal archive, and then what choices you ended up making in terms of what should be included in the film and how these precious artifacts should be utilized to bring your mother, in a sense, fully to life again.
Well, my mom was an avid collector. She and my father, my stepdad, Robert Wagner, was an avid photographer. So they were constantly taking pictures, documenting, you know, every moment of our lives, every birthday, every Easter, their weddings. So we had all that on 16 millimeter and Super 8. So we transferred that to digital. And then my mom, you know, kept every letter that was ever sent to her. She wrote in her journals and her date books. So we had all of that. And, you know, the focus of the documentary is on the stunning life that my mom lived and what a warm and accessible person she was, and also what a modern woman she was. I mean, she fought for equal pay. She fought for LGBTQ rights, all in the 60s and 70s when that wasn't in vogue. So we knew we wanted to emphasize that part of her life as well. And what a loving mother she was, and how much she had wanted to be a mother, and how both my parents really put that front and center.
I know that you were young when your mother died. I know she was just 43 years old, tragically, when she died. And I believe you were a youngster. Were you maybe 10 or 11 or 12, something like that?
I was 11.
I should think that because you were so young when you lost your mother, that in a sense this documentary project represents something more than it otherwise would, because in a sense this has probably been an opportunity for you to discover all kinds of things about your mother that you didn't have a chance to learn directly from her.
It's true. I mean, mostly what the experience of making the documentary did for me is just corroborate all my memories. You know, I knew that I had this charmed childhood. I knew that it was full of animals and laughter and interesting people and warm hugs and stuff. And then, you know, to see it actually in the photographs, to reread letters my mom had written to me or to my stepdad, you know, I just said to myself, I didn't make this up. This really happened. And now I have the opportunity to share it with the world, you know. And I think for viewers to see things visually, maybe instead of listening to them narratively, can be very powerful. So they get to see, you know, her at home in the garden on an Easter egg hunt. They get to see her diving in our swimming pool. They get to see, you know, our dog having puppies, all these things that colored my childhood.
We're speaking with Natasha Gregson-Wagner, who is an actress, but also one of the producers of a brand new documentary called Natalie Wood, What Remains Today. Natalie Wood was Natasha's mother, and this documentary is about to have its premiere on HBO. Natasha Gregson-Wagner, I wonder to what extent the film explores your mother's own childhood, which was certainly a really intriguing one, and of course, in particular, her intriguing relationship with her mother, which seems to have had a whole lot to do with what shaped your mother and what she went on to do. Can you just talk a moment about that?
Of course. We go very deeply into my mother's childhood and her relationship with my grandmother, whom I called Baba. You know, my mom had a complicated relationship with her own mother, but a loving one, quite a loving one. And my grandmother was around, you know, my entire childhood. She was always with me when I was a little girl. But she was very much, she had a plan and a vision that my mother would become a movie star. And I think she willed that into reality. You know, she emigrated here from Russia through China with no money. And the balm for her life was going to the movies. And so she started to play games with my mom, you know, and that's how my mom really learned how to act, was through make-believe.
When you look at your mother's body of work and the films in particular that she was a part of, films like Miracle on 34th Street, Rebel Without a Cause, The Searchers, West Side Story, Gypsy, Splendor in the Grass, that's just a partial list. Which of those films do you think is most emblematic of her qualities as an actress? I mean, if somebody wanted to, in a sense, return to your mother and remember what made her so special on the screen, which of those films do you think is the place to begin?
Wow, that's a beautiful, great question that I haven't been asked. You know, my mom was an incredibly nurturing human. She nurtured her friends, her children, her husband, herself. So, you know, I think you see that warmth and nurturing quality in films like Splendor in the Grass, West Side Story, Rebel Without a Cause. But she also had a fire to her, and she was nobody's fool, and she stood up for herself, and she was a boss. And you see that in a film like Gypsy or Love with the Proper Stranger or This Property is Condemned. So she really was able to bring so many of her strengths as a human being into her work. And, I mean, I guess it's hard to know where to start with her. I think if you have children, you start with Miracle on 34th Street. Otherwise, you start with Rebel, and you kind of just go from there. And West Side Story is a great one to start with, as Steven Spielberg, you know, is doing the remake, which will premiere, I believe, this Christmas.
The intriguing thing about your relationship with your mother, Natalie Wood, is that as she became a mother, she pulled away from the busy life she had had as a professional actress, although by no means was she completely inactive. The years she spent mothering you and your siblings were relatively quiet years for her professionally, at least as far as the outside world was concerned. So I wonder what difference that made in terms of what you knew at the time about her life as a professional actress. I mean, how conscious were you of, in a sense, who she was to the world?
Well, that's a great point. You know, I wasn't that conscious of her being this huge star. I mean, I'd say when I was about 8 or 9, you know, I started to not really appreciate when we would go out and people would want her autograph or want to take her picture. And, you know, she explained to us that she was in movies, and she let us watch her in Miracle on 34th Street or a film she did called The Green Promise, which was one of our favorites as children. So I sort of had an inkling that she was an actress, but I didn't really understand what that meant, really, until I became a senior in high school and my film teacher asked me if he could show the class Splendor in the Grass. And so that was the first time I watched that movie with my senior class, and I was pretty blown away by her beauty, her performance. You know, I didn't realize until then that she was a true actress and a movie star. I mean, she had been nominated for 3 Oscars before the time she was 25 years old.
Incredible. Do you do you spend much time thinking about what she would have done professionally had she not died so young? Does that question intrigue you at all?
Absolutely, and I think it's a great question. And, you know, the truth is I think she would have done a lot. Prior to her death, she was about to star in a stage play of Anastasia at the Amundsen Theater in Los Angeles. She was getting ready to direct. She was going to produce. She would have written a book. I think she would have been on the forefront of, you know, all the changes that we've seen lately in the industry in terms of equal pay for women, LGBTQ rights. You know, she was surrounded by gay people. Her best friends were gay. I grew up around so many of them. You know, she believed in equality. She believed in love. I think she would have done so much more as an actor. In some ways, I feel like she was just getting started.
A last question. You, in your own career as a professional actress, have certainly struck out a very different path from that of your mother. And I wonder, to what extent is that just because you are a different person than your mother, Or was it more of a conscious choice in your part that you really did not want to even attempt to try to follow in her footsteps in terms of making the kind of films she did or being the kind of actress that she was on the screen?
You know, I was certainly daunted by her and her legacy in a lot of ways, and yet compelled to follow in her footsteps. I think I felt a little safer going down the indie route because I was hoping that people maybe wouldn't even know that I was her daughter and they could just see me for an actress in my own right. I also had been slightly traumatized by all the tabloid press that had surrounded her death, and so I didn't want to be in, I didn't want to take the route of a big budget film because I didn't want to have to do a lot of press. So that was sort of why I went down the indie route. I actually hung up my acting shoes in 2012 when my daughter was born because I just wanted to be a full-time mom. So I haven't been acting, but my husband's an actor and I run lines with him. So that's the extent of my acting these days.
Very good. So in a sense, you made a choice very similar to your own mother, I mean, who stepped away at least in large measure from the profession when she wanted to be a very serious, hands-on mother.
I did. It was easy to follow in her footsteps as a mother. I feel that mothering was something she really knew how to do, and she gifted me that. And so I knew that when I became a mother, I wanted to be there 100% all of the time, which I've done, except for the last couple of years when I've been producing this documentary, and I've written a memoir that also comes out on May 5th. So I've been a little busy with that, but I'm back to being a full-time mom, with the exception of all this press.
Very good. The film, again, about to premiere on HBO, is Natalie Wood, What Remains Behind. I am excited to see it. And Natasha Gregson-Wagner, I was very excited to speak with you about it. Very best wishes to you.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure, and best wishes to you, too.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We have a special treat for the next few minutes for anybody who is a fan of science fiction. And actually, even if you're not particularly a science fiction fan, I think you are nevertheless going to find the next few minutes intriguing. I'm going to be speaking with Anne Vandermeer, who is an award-winning, renowned editor in the world of science fiction. And she is especially well-known for gathering together the work of diverse and promising new talents. And she's been doing this work for the last several decades, actually. And her most recent project is a fascinating anthology, a sci-fi anthology, Avatars Incorporated. And it is based on a really intriguing premise and also hooked into a real-life technology competition that is currently underway called the X Prize. And they are, in a sense, kind of both inspiration and co-sponsor of this wonderful sci-fi anthology series. And by the way, it is something that aspiring writers can also be part of. There is currently a Submit Your Story contest that is open through the 8th of May, and we will talk about that as well. Anne Vandermeer, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's first find out a little bit about what drew you in the first place into the world of science fiction. Is this something that you can trace, for instance, to your childhood? And did anything in particular or anyone in particular serve as a catalyst for you?
Well, yes, actually, I can trace this back. And I can trace it back to when I was a child reading the Wizard of Oz book series. You know, when we think about The Wizard of Oz, we think of the one book, you know, that made that famous movie with Judy Garland. But there was actually a whole series of books, and my father had the entire collection from when he was a child. And he and my mom went through a horrible, contentious divorce. But this selection of books was my connection to him. It's what kind of bonded me to him when I was a child, was those books. And so I loved reading those types of books, and then those led me to other books and other books, and so I was totally engrossed in the science fictional world because that's what my father loved, and that's where that all came from, is that we shared this bond of loving this type of work.
I wonder if you could say a word about the intriguing pleasures and challenges that are part of being an editor, just in general, and then in particular, being an editor of a work of science fiction. It seems to me that that probably presents certain opportunities and pleasures and challenges as well that are maybe unique to the sphere of science fiction. Tell us a little bit about this work that you do.
Well, as an editor, it's my job to find the best work that I possibly can, whether it's new fiction or fiction that's already been published and I'm reprinting it. But that's my main job, is the acquisition, the finding it. And sometimes when you're out there reading fiction and looking at all these different things, you see a story that is almost perfect. So the decision is, do I work with this writer? What do I pull out of them? So I feel like it's my job as an editor to seek out those gems, those beautiful stories, and pull them out of the writer. Because here's the thing, a lot of times I notice that when I'm working with a writer, they might not recognize the strengths of their story. They might think that the focus should be in one area when really their strengths lie somewhere else. And so I feel like as an editor, I'm standing in the breach between the writer and the reader, and I am helping the writer pull out the best that's in them to be able to communicate to the reader so that the reader can see the beauty of the story. So I feel like that's my challenge. That's what I need to be doing every single time I approach a story.
Hmm. That actually sounds like a pretty universal challenge for anybody who edits anything. I mean, that should be at the heart and soul of what they were doing. I should think that when we're talking about science fiction, this may not be completely true, but maybe to some extent is true, that because you have writers who, in a sense, can weave their own reality, in a way that is not typical for someone who's writing maybe a romance novel or something where it's set on the planet Earth and with the way that the world works. And of course, in science fiction, one can create all kinds of worlds, and maybe even worlds in which all kinds of different laws apply. And I should think that is one thing that draws writers to the realm of science fiction, and its readers for that matter. But that also means that there's, in a sense, a different kind of infinity of possibilities, and the writer has to sort that all out, and you as the editor have to also sort of sort all that out.
This is true. And there's an additional challenge when you're writing science fiction. You know, regardless of what you're writing, whether it's science fiction or realistic, you're still world building. Because what you put on the page, you need to make sure that it's believable to the reader, whether it's a realistic scene that happens in New York City or if it's happening on Mars. You need to be able to suspend the belief of the reader and make sure that they can buy into what you're trying to share. So, of course, there's more of a challenge when you're writing science fiction because you're creating something that doesn't yet exist.
Hmm.
Maybe it will exist in the future, maybe it won't, but you're creating something that's not quite there. You have to be able to weave in enough of the real world and give the reader enough of a grounding of reality of where they're coming from so that they will suspend the belief and go along with you. Because you're taking them on a journey when you're writing a science fiction story, you're taking them on a journey, and they want to come with you. So they want to believe in you.
I'm also curious how much writing you have done versus editing. I mean, is your professional life taken up almost entirely with the editing of other people's writing, or is some of your time, or at some points in the past, have some of your time and energy been spent in creating something yourself? And I wonder if those are, in a sense, competing interests or competing hungers at all within you.
No, they're not competing hungers at all. Any time that I have to write something, it's like this dark pit in my stomach because I am not a good writer. I do write some things, nonfiction, but only under duress, like introductions to books or articles or things like that. And I can do that. I've also done a ton of technical writing because I worked in the software development field for 30 years. But as far as fiction writing is concerned, I actually hit the plateau of my writing career when I was 8 years old, and I wrote and illustrated a book called Going to Grandma's House. And once I had written that book, I knew that that was the best I was ever going to do with fiction, and I thought I decided I really liked reading better than writing. So
there you go.
So I am a reader. I'm a reader first.
We're speaking with Anne Vandermeer, who is a well-known science fiction editor, and she is the editor of a new anthology series called Avatars Incorporated, which at the moment is 24 stories in all, and built on a really fascinating premise and connected with a real-life technology competition known as the XPRIZE that is, been launched before, and the current XPRIZE competition is sort of halfway through its gestation. Let's talk, first of all, just briefly about this XPRIZE competition, and especially this current incarnation of it, which will help our listeners understand then what Avatars Incorporated is.
Okay, so if you're talking about the actual XPRIZE competition,
yes,
this is a $10 million ANA Avatar XPRIZE. It's a 4-year global competition that is focused on the real-life development of an avatar system. And the purpose of an avatar system allows you to transport a human's senses, actions, and presence into a remote location in real time. So it's not like a robot that you're controlling or a drone or a VR system. It's a true real-life, here's an actual physical thing. And the human is controlling it, but also experiencing everything that is happening around this physical creation. So in this competition, it was launched originally at South by Southwest in 2018, and there are 77 teams around the world. I think it's 19 countries total that are working on this. So 2 years from now, in 2022, the winning team will receive $5 million. So what they're working on right now is integrating multiple technologies to develop a physical, non-autonomous avatar system. So that means the person operating the avatar can see, hear, interact, feel everything in a remote manner. So it's like you're putting yourself there.
And, of course, the point of doing something in this respect is that you are not subjecting yourself to the potential peril of a dangerous situation.
Yes, that's true. But it also goes both ways. By putting the human into the avatar, you're not putting the human that's controlling it in danger, but you're also, if there's humans or non-humans around, you're not putting them in danger either. So think about it in the sense of where we are right now, where you have people in hospitals that can't be with their loved ones because of the virus, and there could be, you know, infection spreading. So if you can be in an avatar and you can be with these people, you're not going to spread the virus.
Exactly. So it is a way to be utterly safe, in a sense, in both directions.
Yes.
It's a fascinating notion,
but
isn't it?
It's really interesting because one of the stories in this anthology proposed the use of an avatar out in the wilderness so that you can observe and document what's happening in nature without the interruption of a human presence. Because you know, if you go out there in nature and you're sitting there, they can smell the human on you, you know. But this way, with an avatar, it's just another thing. It could be a rock for all the animals care. So in that sense, there's another way you can look at the use of an avatar. So that's what's really so cool and interesting about this anthology, is these writers came up with all of these different uses that are well beyond what the original XPRIZE people are working on, and it's very cool.
Right. So it's in a sense, taking this technology and applying it in a sort of limitless way. I mean, taking it to the very fringes of our imagination of what such a technology could mean to us.
Mm-hmm. And that happens a lot. You know, when we first went to the moon and brought back all those different things. The things that the scientists were working on in order to get people on the moon, we use those technologies in our everyday lives now, like cell phones and microwaves. But at the time, they were created for a different purpose.
So
we do the same thing with the avatars.
So explain the kind of central premise of this sci-fi anthology series, again called Avatars Incorporated. It begins with something happening in the distant year 2080.
Right. And what the premise is that this memory chip from the avatar is found, and embedded in the memory chip are all the different lives that this avatar has lived. And that's what these stories are. And the stories are the different time periods and the different uses that this particular avatar was used for.
So, for instance, when we go to the website, we see all of these titles of these various chapters, and to the left will be the year. So from the year 2079 is the story A Mountain to Climb, and from 2071 a story called In the Lands of the Spill. And and each one of these, then, it is the same avatar, but it was a different person making use of that avatar and experiencing
something completely
different.
So the avatar essentially has these multiple personalities, if you think about it that way, because it's these different people controlling it. And they're not just controlling it, they're actually within it, feeling everything that it feels.
And I'm trying to remember, are we ever told what this avatar looks like? I mean, if we saw it, what would we think it was?
Well, here's the thing. When you're dealing with 24 different writers, and they all have their ideas of where they want the story to go, you can't constrain them by saying it's got to be A, B, and C. So we kind of left the actual look and feel of the avatar a little bit vague and open so that the writers have the ability to, and the space to be able to write their stories. So it's humanoid in shape. You know, it's not like a box or something like that. It's humanoid in shape, and that's pretty much where we left it. So that's the prompt that we gave to the writers, is here's what it is, but pretty much you do what you want with it. And if you think about it, with technology, things are constantly changing. So even though the avatar might be one thing in this year, 10 years from now it might actually look completely different. Because here's the other thing, is you're just talking about the memory chip that's within the avatar. So having the memory chip allowed the writers to be able to explore even beyond just one single piece of machinery, because that memory chip could be put in various different avatar bodies. You see what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
Because originally, when Eric and I were working on this anthology, we had the idea that it was just going to be this one mechanical avatar. But because the writers were doing so many wonderful things, it was like, well, in order to, we can't make the writer change to fit our premise, but we can expand our premise to allow the writers that freedom. And that's what we were able to do. So if you think about the memory chip, you know, it's like when you have a cell phone and you want to upgrade to a new cell phone. They take the little chip out of your old phone, put it in the new one, and voila, there's all your contacts.
Right, or a zip drive or something. I mean,
yeah.
Something that is a small tool that can be utilized in various devices of various levels of complexity and sophistication. Yeah, that's a very rich scenario that makes a lot of different things possible. Beyond the most basic, was your sort of prompt for your writers, did it include anything else, or were all bets off and were they free to do whatever they wanted to do?
Well, they were pretty much free to do whatever they wanted to do, but we did give them a caveat where we didn't want to see the use of avatar in wars. You know, that was just, you know, let's go beyond that, because that seems to be a default for a lot of these things, you know, and the Defense Department's always going to be looking at everything, but we wanted to explore beyond that. So we didn't want to have that tired old trope of, you know, an army of avatars or like a super assassin or something like that, so that was really the only thing that we just said, you know. And the other thing is that when we were working with the different writers, we wanted them to give us their ideas ahead of time so that we could make sure that we didn't have an overlap of people writing the same stories. You know, mm-hmm. we wanted to make sure that there was enough diversity in the themes and the stories that they were telling so that that would work as well. And it's amazing to me how we didn't really have any overlap at all. Every single story that came out was completely unique, and you can't say this one's like that one. So we were very fortunate with that.
And it seems as though you were also very anxious to maintain or preserve the diverse voices of all of these different writers. And of course, you as the editor could have made a different choice and opted for something in which there would be, in a sense, more sort of seamless sameness between all of these different stories, and that's clearly not what you wanted.
No, I've never worked that way. I've always worked with diverse storytelling and diverse voices because that makes life more interesting, and it makes for a better project overall. Mm.
So we have not yet mentioned the fact that that there is a Submit Your Story contest that is underway, and I want to mention that when you go to the website to read the various stories from Avatars Incorporated, towards the very top of this column of titles is a place that says, I think, Submit the Missing Story. And I'm assuming that whatever wins this contest is going to be slotted right in there to take its place with these other stories.
Yes, and it's just a really great idea to get people thinking, because I know from past experience that when you're reading something or even watching something on TV, your mind starts working and you start coming up with ideas of like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if they had done this? What about that? What if this? You know, and so this gives these other writers out in the world an opportunity to write their own stories within this universe. And I just think it's a great thing, especially right now, for people to be able to use their imaginations and to be creative in this way. Especially right now, it's a really good thing to do. And this anthology that's online is 100% completely free and available to anyone who wants to read it. They can read it online at the website, avatars.inc, or they could download it as a free ebook. So either way that you want to read it. And the other thing that's so great about this, every single story is lavishly illustrated by a different artist. And the artwork is amazing. It will just blow you away.
I quite agree, and I'm really glad you mentioned that. And the artwork is also as diverse as the writing style of these various authors. So it is really incredibly rich. I know that people can go to the website to see, in a sense, all of the rules, although there actually aren't all that many, but just capsulize for somebody who feels like they maybe want to throw something together and submit it as part of this contest. What are you looking for from writers who might enter?
We're looking for another story within that universe where an avatar is being used for a certain purpose. We're looking for stories around the $3,500 word range, and each writer can only submit one story. So submit your best. So we're asking for that. The deadline is May 8th, so you have about a week to get them in.
And I should think that this is also something where somebody who is a aspiring science fiction writer could conceivably have something that they have already written. They might have multiple stories that they have already written that, without too much trouble, could be adapted for this scenario.
That's very possible.
Yeah.
Welcome that.
Remind people again of the website where they can not only find the anthology, but also find out more information.
The website is avatars.inc. So it's AVATARS.INC, avatars.inc.
And the editor of Avatars, Inc. is Anne Vandermeer. Anne Vandermeer, it was a great pleasure for me to speak with you. Thank you so much and best wishes.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and we finish out today's program with an interview that dates back to 2012. And it is certainly a thrilling honor to once again be able to speak with one of the most gifted novelists before the American public today, a best-selling author many times over, Jodi Picoult's latest novel is called Lone Wolf, and it is an absolute masterpiece. And so I'm thrilled at this opportunity to be able to speak with the author. Jodi Picoult, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you.
We last spoke about a very different novel, which involved graphic novels, the world of comic books and so on. And that's several books ago. This time we are talking about, as the title suggests, a book which has something to do with The Amazing Wolf, and drawing some fascinating parallels and distinctions between the way wolves function and the way human families sometimes function or dysfunction, if there is such a verb. Tell us, first of all, what piqued your interest in the wolf and made you realize it would be fertile ground for a novel?
Well, actually, the novel did not begin with wolves. The novels began with a thought about end-of-life care and about facing the question about whether to terminate life support. It was about 10 years ago. I was on a plane going home to New Hampshire, and I was seated beside a man who is a neurologist at a local hospital where I live. And he was talking about all of the traumatic brain injury patients that he had seen and some of the really horrific end-of-life decisions that were made in the wake of those traumatic brain injuries. And I said to him, you know, I am not ready to write this book now, but one day I'm going to be, and I'm going to get in touch with you, so please remember my name. And 10 years later, I called him, and he said, I remember you. I've been following your career. You're doing great. And he was more than happy to help me out, and that really was the genesis of Lone Wolf. But I began to think about the character, Luke Warren, who on page one is in the car accident that causes this traumatic brain injury. And I began one morning to just think about wolves. Didn't really know why, but I began to wonder what would happen if I created a character who, instead of just watching wolves from afar to learn about them, actually insinuates himself into a wolf pack to learn from within. And I really thought I was creating someone completely unique, only to find out, of course, that there was a man who did this for real. And I contacted him. His name is Sean Ellis. He lives in Devon in the United Kingdom. And when he was in America for a while working with the Nez Perce Indians, he managed to insinuate himself into a wild pack in Canada, in the Rockies. And I talked to him at length. I met with him. I met with the wolves that he now has in captivity, some of them, in Devon in the United Kingdom. And what he taught me was that wolves really don't deserve the bad rap that they tend to get. They are actually extremely intelligent animals, not cold-blooded killers. And for them, nothing matters more than family. Everyone has a very prescribed, important role within the family dynamic. And if you can't make the choices and the decisions and the actions that you need to within your role, you need to be replaced. And that whole situation seemed to dovetail beautifully as a metaphor with the story I was trying to write.
And, of course, what we have here is a family that has been really torn apart by a lot of different factors. And in a sense, you are drawing quite a stark contrast between this, what seems at least to largely be a fairly tidy and predictable sort of hierarchy in these wolf packs. In contrast to that, a family in which nobody seems to know exactly where they fit in or what role they play with the other.
Right. You know, the thing about a wolf pack is, as long as you're doing your job, you are definitely part of the pack and everyone will lay down their lives for you. If you're not, then you're going to be kicked out or replaced or edged out in some way. It's a little militaristic. It's also a little like a really tight family.
Right.
It functions very much like the mafia, actually.
And it was fascinating to learn at one point about how beyond the alpha wolf that we all know about, there are beta wolves and tester wolves and diffuser wolves. I mean, this is a very complex system that seems to work really well.
That's right. And, you know, and a lot of people have heard misinformation, too, about it. Most people assume that the big, tough, strong wolf, the first one you meet in a pack, must be the alpha. It's actually not. It's the beta wolf. The beta is the enforcer, the mafia thug, and the one who is going to come out first because he's the bravest. But he's protecting the alpha, who always hides behind because the alpha is the collective brains of the group and the one who makes all the decisions, all the choices, and is really thinking so many steps ahead of where you would imagine. An alpha can hear the change in a heartbeat of an animal or human from 6 to 7 feet away.
Mm.
And she catches food based on how much adrenaline is running through its system. She can actually pump up the adrenaline before they make a kill so that That way, when the pack feeds off the animal, they have adrenaline in their system, and that makes them look stronger to other packs in the area when they mark their territory by urinating around it.
Fascinating.
So all of these things are amazing.
Yeah. So the name of the novel is Lone Wolf, and at one point we hear in the voice of Luke Warren, the man who's been caught in this car crash and suffered this terrible injury, at one point is describing the lives of wolves. He says, imagine being all alone in the wild. You are another animal's potential prey, a rival pack's enemy. You know that most packs will be prowling between dusk and dawn. And so for a lone wolf, not with a pack, how do they respond to the call that they hear in the distance? This is a fascinating...
A lone wolf.
Yes.
I was going to say a lone wolf is always looking for a pack. There's safety in numbers.
Right.
And even a pack of two is better than being a pack of one.
Right. And, of course, in stark contrast to this, or yet a better said, I suppose, in very neat parallel, is the story then of Luke Warren's son, who has, in a sense, left the family, left his father, is, in a sense, a lone wolf himself. And the circumstances of this accident suddenly thrust him back into the heart of this family.
That's right.
What an interesting parallel to draw. What was it like to explore that?
It was great. I learned so much about wolves, so much more than I ever thought I'd know about wolves. And I'm pretty sure anyone who reads the book will feel the same way.
Right.
You know, and the interesting thing is, you know, we do tend to anthropomorphize their behavior, to assume the reason they're doing it is because of love or some kind of affection or, you know, something that we would experience. And that's not really why wolves do what they do. They do it because they depend on each other. It's
right.
Really, at the bottom basic level, it's a matter of instinct and survival. And at the end of the day, if you can look around you and count all the wolves in your pack and say, we're all still here, that's a good day.
Yeah.
It's really that simple.
What I find fascinating is that you write so authentically about the experience of the son who left home, wrote a brief little note, and then was gone. And Edward, in a sense, is a human lone wolf. And I assume this is something you yourself have never done or never completely experienced the way that Edward has experienced it in his life. And yet you write about it as though you know exactly what it would feel like to...
Well, thank you for that. But, you know, I tend to write many male characters. I've never been a man either, so... I think it's just a matter of having some empathy and being able to try on someone else's skin and voice for size.
Right, I suppose. And one of the things I appreciate is that you also do such an interesting job of peeling away the details of the backstory of this family and these various characters very, very slowly and very, very carefully. I wonder if you could just say a quick word about how an author makes those choices about what to reveal when in the course of a novel.
That's actually, it's a very hard thing to talk about because it's something that comes with time and, you know, with technical expertise. One of the hardest decisions that I make every time I start a novel is how much do I reveal at the beginning. You do want to play it out. You want to spin it out so that there's a little bit of mystery and suspense. Sometimes it's easy because sometimes your character doesn't know anything and has to discover it along with the narrator, with the reader. But sometimes your narrator does know things and is holding back and is an unreliable narrator, and that becomes an even more challenging situation. That's certainly the case in this book. Both Kara and Edward, the two children of Luke Warren, who are siblings fighting over his life decisions, they both have a secret. And we don't find that out until much later in the book. And that drives, in part, why they are each so determined to either keep their father alive or perhaps to turn off life support. You can't separate out their own reasons from their decisions about their father's health care.
It's a fascinating, terrible dilemma in which they find themselves, having to make such crucial decisions about a man that neither of them feel like they fully know or have no way of knowing what his wishes would be. And it is, of course, a position many families find themselves in, one of many fascinating facets to your wonderful novel called Lone Wolf.
Right.
It's an Atria book, and the author, Jodi Picco. Jodi Picco, you've done it again. Congratulations on this wonderful book.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show,
a book called The Conquest of Malaria, which looks at the devastation wrought by malaria, particularly in the nation of Italy, and the courageous efforts that were made to try to combat this terrible disease. On Thursday's morning show, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, with his monthly visit to the program. And on Friday, we hear from Kevin Crosby, a physics professor at Carthage, and three of his finest students who have secured a prestigious